In this episode of Shaping the Future, I'm inside the COP. And it's been an interesting week talking to a lot of people, attending events, conducting interviews with scientists, looking at really worrying scientific presentations about how close we are to tipping points, some that we've already crossed, and yet seeing how disconnected they are from the general discourse here and the press releases that we're bombarded with and that come out of the COP. This interview is with Kevin Anderson, particularly addresses some of these things and tries to give it some perspective. I've also included a clip with John Kerry where he actually says that this is a very ambitious COP, but, and then also Richard Bamber, a small clip from that I will actually publish the whole interview with Richard and his colleagues who are presenting on the Cryosphere stand or pavilion, which is actually an incredible place to go and get some real information about what this COP should be about, perhaps. So, and also how we should maybe address our action towards it. So, thanks for listening. I'll be back very shortly.
We will leave Glasgow. I think we're going to have the greatest increase in ambition we've ever had. The real issue is going to be follow-up.
You've been coming to COPs for nearly 20 years. You know the lay of the land and the hype and everything else. When you listen to what we heard yesterday from so many different quarters, does it fill you with hope that this time we're going to do it? What's your outlook?
That's a really difficult question. It's difficult because my honest answer is I'm not overly optimistic.
What drives your sort of reasoning?
Because I've seen the negotiations, I've seen the processes, I've seen the rhetoric before. I don't see anything significantly different here.
Okay. So pessimism with the world leaders, and we've got to try and look for something else. John Kerry has pointed out that there has been more ambition at this COP than any preceding COP, but highlights that we should be careful because it's really after the COP where things go a bit awry.
Yes.
What do you make of that? Firstly, comment on the ambition, the pledges, the goodwill, and everyone is coming to the table here in Glasgow, and it is going to lead us to a celebration, I think, in a week and a half's time. And what do you make of all of that?
Well, we haven't finished this COP yet, so I think it's perhaps a bit advanced to be saying that this is more ambition at this COP. I think the Paris COP, where we came up with a fairly strong piece of legislation internationally, whereby we were going to hold emissions well below 2 degrees centigrade and ideally aim for 1.5, and that was hugely ambitious. This COP is really about, well, what are the reduction rates that are needed, the reduction levels that are needed to deliver on that 1.5, particularly the 1.5. We had the G7 communique earlier this year, which reinforced the importance of 1.5. And when you listen to the announcements on various net zero targets and other various forms of targets on deforestation and so forth, these fall far, far short of our 1.5 degree C commitment. In fact, I would say they fall far short of our 2 degree centigrade commitments as well. So I'm not witnessing the same level of ambition that John Kerry is interpreting from what's happening here within the COP.
Okay, and if that's the case, and you were on the same stand as me, listening to the same scientific presentations on ice loss and glaciers, etc. What do you make of that disparity? Because they were quite chilling forecasts, chilling reasons why we have to hold temperature, why we have to urgently reduce, and yet no world leader knows that these are going on or has even bothered to check them out. What do you make of that disparity?
Yeah. Well, this COP, like a lot of COPs actually, it's two separate planets. You've got planet politics, which is where you get these grand speeches and the climate glitterati flying in, making wonderful high-level statements, which are just pretty much vacuous nonsense. And you've got the other side of the COP, where people, whether it's the scientific community or indeed some of the civil society groups, are talking about the scale of the challenge necessary to meet the commitments that the policymakers have actually made at previous COPs. So these are just two separate planets with almost no connection between them. And that I find really quite deeply disturbing, because there's a role between those two, which I think really is the role of journalism, and I would argue the role of some of the more, well, the role of academia, my sort of realm, but particularly the more senior ones who either through their silence or through their desire to be part of this what I refer to as the climate glitterati, this great and good, these grand statements, actually supportive of them, at least in public. In private, they say something completely different, of course. And so I think there's a gap between these two that is not being filled by good journalism, by and large, and it's not being filled by the academics holding our leaders and others to account for the statements that they are making.
Okay, we'll come back to the journalism in a minute, but when you talk about the role of the great and the good, and they are very much presented here, and I'd say almost to the point of worship, are they the right people to be leading us through this?
These are people who have set up and hugely benefited from a structure in a society that has brought about the climate challenge that we face today, has brought around the whole series of ecological crises that we're also having to face. And then we're asking those same people, well, how should we get out of this problem? Certainly there will be some important contribution that they can make, but that they are the ones that are demonstrating the leadership, they're the ones that are capturing the essence of what we need to do, I think it's completely misguided. You'll get far more understanding of the challenges by attending many of the side events here, whether they're the science side events or indeed many of the civil society side events, than you would ever get from the packed assemblies of people. Who on earth are these people that go to listen to these empty, vacuous speeches that we've heard cop after cop after cop as emissions have just gone up and up and up? And of course, every country is showing leadership. Everyone claims that they're the country that demonstrates leadership. I mean, the UK is a wonderful example of that. And yet, when you look at the total emissions, they're still going up. So the climate hasn't spotted this leadership yet. What we find is what the climate has seen is ongoing growing emissions, with the only reduction in emissions, really significant reduction, coming thanks to the tragedy that was the COVID crisis. But we now, as we're coming out of that COVID crisis, what are we seeing? Business as usual. And it's just surrounded here by this shiny green glow that has nothing to do with the commitments that we're making and everything to do with our ongoing failure to address climate change.
Okay, and one of the things that I've noticed here, you've talked about the role of journalism and falling short of journalism quite a lot on Twitter, public sort of forum, if you like. I mean, I noticed at this COP, I'm getting, as someone here from the media, I'm getting more emails, quite long briefings from 10 Downing Street than any other organisation. I mean, what do you think of that? Because that's quite, to me, it's peculiar. I've never had this before at any COP, and it's almost like a narrative control in a funny way.
Well, I think it's exactly what it is. I mean, it's quite Orwellian that the journalists have been told, really, or at least highly recommended, to report the messages that are coming from Number 10. And those messages, of course, are far removed from what the science is saying is necessary to deliver on the commitments that Number 10 has made. Number 10 being obviously where the Prime Minister lives in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
So I think it's been, there's an attempt to very carefully choreograph what is happening here. Again, though, if the journalists, and I'm being probably a little bit unfair here, I think if the mainstream journalists show greater integrity about trying to unpick what is coming and reveal what's underneath the bonnet, if you like, so that the public can make their own informed decisions about what's really happening, that would probably be fine. We'll put up with the deliberate choreography from government. But I think they haven't done that. At least the mainstream journalists haven't done that. And neither, again, as I said before, have many of the senior academics. And I even go as far as say quite a few of the people in some of the senior NGOs. That we've all bought into a narrative of we mustn't remove hope. We mustn't say it as it is. It's not in public. And we must portray quite a jolly, cheery message that we can have win-win, we can have green growth, we can improve the quality of life for everyone, we can level up, we can do all of these things and address this enormous challenge of climate change. But that climate change is one, our commitments around climate change, around 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade, they can be translated through the science into the rates of change that we require. And these are completely different to this sort of green growth rhetoric that dominates and echoes around COP26.
The word echo is extremely pertinent because it is a massive echo chamber. And if you take all the things we've just mentioned, there's a huge disparity now with a growing cynicism, and polling recently showing that 80% of people in the UK climate's on their radar, they're starting to worry about it. Now, if you go out into Glasgow today, there was protests of one nature, and there's going to be more tomorrow, more Friday, more Saturday. Do you think that all of these sort of things possibly worked previously, and now they're starting to not work? People are saying, hang on a minute, this is garbage. They're spotting the lies.
Yeah.
And what do you think? I mean, do you see a direction of flow with the way the other side?
There's a lot in what you're asking.
I know.
But the two elements, two ways I'll think about this. First is, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, do I have any real sense of where hope might, genuine hope, hope that's based on substance, where that might reside? And so I'm really struggling to see that. But now I think that has changed. For me, it has changed. And that hope has come out not from the great and good, not from the leaders. In fact, they've been removing that hope, as I see it, hope that's substantiated anyway. That hope has come from the sort of ragtag of civil society groups, from the youth movements, from the different other civil society groups that are out there that are not just the historically we'd call them the usual suspects. Now, there are all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds, and many, many parts of the world that are recognising the challenge. I mean, they're seeing the challenge anyway around them a lot of the time of climate change. And then they're hearing, of course, the rhetorical nonsense from our leaders. So I think the hope resides, and there's a wide recognition now amongst many in civil society that we need to address this issue. And I think that has also opened up a space for dialogue, particularly building on the 1.5 degree centigrade that came out of Paris, which wasn't very ambitious. But that combination of the dialogue that civil society have opened up around 1.5 also gives space, I think, for the early career academics, the ones who haven't yet lost their integrity in academia, to actually start to address these problems seriously. So there is some sort of coming together of a new sort of messy partnership that I think is asking questions that are simply not being addressed by our senior leadership. And I go one bit, a little bit further than that, which may be helpful or may not be, and then I apologise for the language in this. My closest friend has never been to university, left school at 16, no qualifications. There's a real bright spark. He now runs a fish and chip shop. And he watches the news. He and I don't discuss climate change a lot. We're cycling friends and we discuss other things. And he sent me a message of the day, just said, it's just hot air from hypocritical tossers. And that language isn't something I would use as an academic. But actually, I think it cuts away the crap, it cuts away the fluff and nonsense, and it says it as it is. And that's what we've heard here. And I think most of the public see straight through the hypocritical tosses that pervade the pavilions here, that dominate the dialogue in the mainstream media.
And do you think it's this idea of hypocrisy, lying, which is really what we're talking about, that's going to keep the response from civil society? Because if it's hopeless, then people don't, they accept that it's hopeless and they despair, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But if they actually think they're being bullshitted, if you want to use colourful language, at the same time, then they respond. Then it's like, well, hang on. Like, even Kerry admitted it in his statement. He's going to, all these pledges, we've seen more than we've ever seen before. But once they leave, they forget.
Yeah, yeah. The proof is in the pudding, and the one thing you can guarantee with the people from here, they have no intention of providing any pudding to be eaten after the COP. That failure, because it is so clearly evident, even despite the fact I think the mainstream media has really abdicated its responsibility to bring that to the public's eye, it's so obvious now that I think many people in civil society are aware and realise that change must be brought about. They're not sure quite how to do it, but in their various ways they're engaging. And in my view, in their various forms of engagement are changing the tenor of the debate. Now, whether they can change the tenor of that debate quickly enough to respond to our 1.5 degrees challenges, we don't know. But I think it's highly unlikely for 1.5 degrees centigrade. It's still possible just about for two. But it will require the way that civil society has really taken the science, and this is bizarre, this really, that to me, the messy partnerships of civil society have been much more in line with the science in terms of what we need to do about climate change than the scientists have been. So there's this we often get this discussion that climate denial. Okay, there's a few small mad fringes around the world that still have that. But I think more dangerous than that has been something that I now call mitigation denial. And that is often even carried out by the climate scientists, by a lot of the senior academics, by the senior politicians and so forth. There, we're denying the levels of emission reductions that are necessary, the levels of mitigation that are necessary to deliver on the commitments that we've made that are informed by the science. But civil society has somehow managed to grasp that.
Yeah.
And it sees through that you know, the vacuous speeches and so forth that we've heard here.
Okay. And I suppose the next progression is change will be emergent out of this as opposed to something we can forecast or design.
Without a doubt, the change will be emergent. And I don't think we shouldn't dismiss, if you like, call it top-down leadership. That's an important part of it. But leadership doesn't just occur top-down, it occurs bottom-up. And it is a messy partnership between the two. And it seems to me at the moment, the stronger partner there in terms of actually some sort of integrity and cogency is actually that coming out of civil society and perhaps some of the earlier career researchers. And the other part, the leadership across the board, whether that's in business leaders, whether it's our policymakers, perhaps some local policymakers, some of those are showing more leadership, but certainly national level and international level, within the finance sector and so forth, we're not seeing any leadership there. It's just relatively vacuous nonsense. And I go further and try to remove any political concerns I have here, but you know, when I hear and see you do some of these events, the Norman Fosters of this world, the Mark Carnes of this world, and lots of the other very senior people involved in climate change, the people you see on all of the screens here, the rooms are rammed full of people, and mostly are presumably journalists reporting what they're saying, that these people encapture the problem that we face. You're not going to find solutions here when they are having friendly banter at the beginning between John Kerry and Norman Foster about where they, you know, the houses that they have in California, I think it's kind of they're next door to each other. But then they also have, of course, properties elsewhere in the world. They fly between them, probably in business class, sometimes in their private jets. And that percolates down also to quite a lot of other senior layers in our society. That this particular group, of which, of course, many of us senior academics are part, at least on the fringes of it, that particular group, I think, encapsulates all that is wrong in our response to climate change. That we are unprepared to recognise that this is an issue of consumption, and that issue of consumption is being driven by a relatively small group in our society. They're spread across all the countries of the world, but they're very small parts of each country.
So really you're saying that in this discussion, which we're meant to be having here, they are actually irrelevant from meaningful change.
From meaningful change, they are the obstacles to meaningful change. Now some of these people are well-meaning. I don't believe that all of them are at all. But some of them are well-meaning. But you won't find even the well-meaning ones in the cryosphere listening to talks on enhanced melting of Greenland ice sheets. You won't find them at these events. You won't find them anywhere engaged in the tangible, physical nature of the challenge that we face. And I come back to sort of a language I regularly use, that physics doesn't care about legal niceties, eloquent speeches, sharp suits. It only cares about the CO2 molecules. And until this group start to recognize that climate change will respond to the physics and not the ephemeral politics, we will continue to fail.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a very good place to leave it. And okay. In fact, physics is the only party here not negotiating.
Thanks again for listening. If you are interested to help support this series and help expand the discussion around climate topics, then please do consider backing my channel via Patreon. It will help me produce more content and you will also gain access to more expert interviews. It would be great to engage more with audiences too and understand your views on these topics.